There's a Texas oil man who, over the last few years, has been discreetly buying his way into every aspect of the oil industry in Utah's Uinta Basin. His name is Jim Finley, and he controls a good part of the supply chain of a type of oil called waxy crude. Now, to understand the story, you have to understand the waxy crude, or Uinta wax, as it's called. It's oil, but it's gunky oil. They say it has the consistency of shoe polish, and the demand for this stuff is growing. They use it in lubricants and makeup products and building materials. The journalist Christy Angelo of the Huffington Post has been covering this story and recently published an article about Jim Finley's vision for the Uinta Basin, how he plans to nearly triple the production of waxy crude there. And what that would mean is hundreds and hundreds of oil tanker trucks every day moving from the oil fields in the Mitton Bench to rail lines in Carbon County. D'Angelo told us recently that Finley first learned about the waxy crude in the Uinta Basin in 2008. This was when his company had purchased some oil leases from an El Paso gas company. So Finley went out to the basin in February of that year, and he had with him Brent Talbot, president of Finley Resources. Here's Chris D'Angelo.
As Talbot tells it, you know, they're there on a super snowy day. It's, you know, below freezing, and Talbot sort of looks to Finley and says something to the effect of, you know, what are we doing here? We've got all these other operations in warm states. What are we doing? And he talks about how his view on the basin quickly changed because they started assessing what was there and found just massive reserves. And I think he described them as being just waiting to be exploited.
And what they had found were these massive hydrocarbon reserves in the deep layers of rock, one layer on top of another layer on top of another one. The industry calls this a stacked pay. Talbot said it was the best oil they had ever seen. Finley himself called it the best producing rock in all of the United States.
You know, since then, the Uinta Basin is really his main priority right now. I mean, if you go to the company website, it's front and center. Uinta Wax is their main play. They've invested a ton of resources and time into the basin. They currently lease, I think, 340,000 acres. They've acquired several companies. They own one of the main transloading facilities where they're putting this stuff on rail cars to ship it out to Gulf Coast refineries. They're doing a lot. Everybody I talked to for the piece, you know, really gave him credit. He's a smart guy. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to market this stuff. He knows how to boost production and secure taxpayer dollars to help him along the way. You know, it's pretty clear to me that he has operations in several other states, but this has really become his bread and butter, so to speak.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Jim Finley and his vision for Utah's Uinta Basin. In his story for the Huffington Post, Chris D'Angelo called Finley a bit of a ghost.
Yeah, he really doesn't show up in public very often. I mean, there are two or three presentations that I found where he talks about, you know, the unique qualities of the wax and their vision for the basin and all of the things they have going to boost exports. But if it weren't, and I put this in the piece, if it weren't for, you know, a press release that a college put out about a partnership with Finley Resources and, you know, one presentation that he gave to the Utah Taxpayers Association, I don't know that I'd know what he looks like. And that's interesting because within industry circles, he really is kind of the man of the hour in the basin. There's a really funny moment. He was presenting to the Seven Counties Infrastructure Coalition, which has really spearheaded the Uinta Rail project, where at the end of it, a commissioner, you know, thanks him for taking the time and talks about how he came here on his own dime and how it was really hard to get him on the schedule, you know. And, you know, he never heard back from Finley himself. He heard back from another employee of Finley Resources. And Finley jokes, you know, sometimes no one knows where I am. And somebody in the audience yells out, on purpose. And Jim Finley repeats him, you know, on purpose and chuckles. He is very important to what's happening in the basin, but he is largely behind the scenes.
You say that he's played a key role in spearheading an oil boom here, an oil boom that, as you say, has kind of long evaded the basin. Talk a little bit about that. What's the role that he's played in the basin?
He runs two main companies in the basin, Finley Resources and Uinta Wax Operating LLC. Those two companies currently operate across 340,000 acres, I believe. We've got, I think, three producing wells. But more importantly, in 2020, they acquired a 50% stake in a loadout facility in Helper, Utah, that's on Bureau of Land Management land. And this is a historically a coal transloading facility. They've bought up a bunch of rail cars, heated tanker cars. You know, this is what Brent Talbot says is the biggest story in the basin, because it has allowed Finley and other producers to put this stuff on rail, keep it heated, and get it to Gulf Coast refineries where they, you know, there's a higher market value. He sort of broke the barrier for getting this stuff out of the state and not being beholden to Salt Lake City refinery capacity. And, you know, as Finley talks about it, this is just the start. They have every intention of exporting more and more of this stuff, whether the railroad gets built or not.
Let's talk about the stuff that we're talking about. Let's go to the crude. Tell us about this particular kind of crude oil that so interests Jim Finley, this waxy crude, the wax. Tell us about this. What's distinct and what's unique about it?
Yeah, so it is unique in the sense that it's low in metals, it's low in acids, it's low in sulfur, and it's used in a whole bunch of non-combustion products. It serves as a feedstock for lubricants. Jim Finley has talked about how they don't know this for a fact, but he thinks the drive and demand from big refineries like Exxon and Motiva in the Gulf is specifically because of its use in wind turbines as lubricants. But he talks about it being used in everything from Wrigley chewing gum and car thermostats and heat pumps. You know, he's really pushing this message of, we have this very pure hydrocarbon. He calls it green. He calls it a transition fuel. There's one presentation where he says, I think this will be the last fossil fuel ever produced on Earth.
So as the name implies, it's gooey. It's thick, I guess. And that kind of gets us to the problem with the crude, is that it requires this special handling to get it eventually to a refinery. So it's complicated to transport. And this has limited the use of it, I guess. Talk a little bit about this part, because it requires some extra care, I guess.
Yeah. I think the funniest comparison I've seen is that it's like bacon fat.
Wow.
You know, if you leave it out, it sort of coagulates and turns to a solid. So the challenge with this is that it's one thing to get this to Salt Lake, right? Put it in an insulated tanker truck, drive it over there.
Yeah.
It doesn't have time to turn to this solid. When it is solidified, it's a much different density. So it expands and contracts based on whether it's liquid or solid. What they're doing now is taking it out of the basin on insulated tanker trucks to these transloading facilities. And then from there, they're transloading it onto these kind of specialty train cars that have coils and are insulated, and they can ship it in its liquid form down to these Gulf Coast refineries.
So this waxy crude, if it's below a certain temperature, I think it's like 110 degrees, it's semi-solid, has to be heated to be transported. It adds to the cost. It's also in the Uinta Basin, which is pretty remote. And the only place that at least initially is that you could get this stuff before it became congealed was Salt Lake City. And then they hit this wall you write about, that refineries in Salt Lake City were where they were sending this stuff, hit their limit. And this is where Finley starts thinking about ways of, as he puts it, breaking the export barrier.
Brent Talbot talked about this in his presentation. He talked about, you know, for years, sort of like the refineries in Salt Lake were saying, you know, this stuff is a pain, you know, we'll only take it at a discount. And so he talks about having hired this consultant to like look at the product, figure out what they had, you know, where they might be able to market this, what its uses would be, who would want it. And the consultant, as Talbot says, you know, came back to them and was like, this is the best stuff we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. This is going to be in really high demand if you can get it down to these big refineries that are capable of dealing with it. And so they're already shipping. I think the numbers kind of change, but I think it's probably 40 or 50,000 barrels a day down to the Exxon refinery in Port Arthur, I believe. And then there's a Motiva refinery, which is the Saudi-owned refinery. And Finley has talked a lot about, you know, having secured contracts for into future years. And they have other big refineries that are interested in this stuff, that Exxon and Motiva want 30,000 barrels of it a day. Single companies want 30,000 barrels. They're shipping 30 or 40 or 50,000 collectively, all the producers today. So they have grand plans to, without the railroad, to ship 100, 200,000 barrels a day out of state.
Where does the railroad fit, though? Because we should talk about this idea for a railway, because it's pretty ambitious and it's pretty controversial. It's a $3 billion, I think, what is it, 88-mile rail line that would connect the Uinta Basin to the national railway system. Talk about where that fits in the story.
There have been a lot of several past efforts to build a railway out of the basin for this reason, and they've all sort of fizzled until this one. And this one was really kind of chugging along. There's a county coalition called the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition that has really spearheaded this. But it would basically allow for producers to triple current production to 350,000 barrels a day.
So the railway is this idea, but right now it's stalled. It's kind of a non-starter for a few reasons. One of them is the Forest Service withdrew their approval to grant a right-of-way for the rail. There have been a few other problems. So for right now, the rail line, the expansion of that rail line, isn't going to work.
Yeah, so the first kind of blow that it took was in August when an appeals court vacated the Surface Transportation Board's permit approval, you know, citing that they failed to properly consider climate risks. And then the second big blow was the Forest Service withdrawing its approval of a right-of-way to go through 12 miles of the Ashley National Forest. Those two things really set this back to square one in a lot of ways. I did see a couple of weeks ago the Salt Lake Tribune reported that the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition is now trying to secure, I think it's $750,000 in general fund money from the Utah General Fund to try to push this case to the Supreme Court. There have been some other efforts in Congress to try to rubber stamp this thing, sort of in the same way that the Mountain Valley Pipeline was approved via legislation. So the backers of this railway are not, you know, giving up on this. I think they're in it for the long haul. But in the meantime, Finley has spearheaded a lot of other infrastructure to move this stuff in the meantime.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So Finley and other producers in the basin run into this problem with the rail project. That was sort of plan A, although it's more complicated than that, as you've said in your reporting. But they have a plan B that was actually always sort of in their mind, and that's trucks, lots and lots of trucks.
Yeah, so it's been sort of portrayed as a plan B. Finley calls it a stepping stone to sort of the large-scale production that they'd like to see. But essentially, it involves hundreds and hundreds of trucks running between the basin to these transloading facilities in Helper and Price, I believe. And, you know, it's basically insulated tanker trucks, often one behind the other, traversing Highway 191 through the mountains, then, you know, loading this stuff onto rail cars. I think they're at 900 rail cars, and if they kind of see this thing through, it would be 3,000. There'd be a fourfold increase in truck traffic on Highway 191. That presents a whole lot of other issues for public safety, for sensitive archaeological sites.
I want to ask you more about Jim Finley's banking on the what sounds like vast expansion of trucking in the Uinta Basin to get it to this waxy crude to where it needs to go. He buys a transporting facility. But I also wanted to ask you about one of the other things. You say he's partnered with a local college to do trucker certifications so people can get trained in hauling this stuff in trucks. Say more about that part.
Yeah, that's sort of one of the more interesting moves in the sense that, you know, he is building a growing fleet of rail cars. But when it comes to trucking, he partnered with Uinta Basin Technical College to basically do a sort of advanced CDL licensing program to train truckers to haul this stuff out of the basin, because they're going to need, you know, to see this through, they're going to need a lot more truckers. They're going to need a lot more trucks. You know, I think it's like a fourfold increase in truckers. I mean, we're talking about I think on Highway 191, if their kind of vision for this plays out, it's like a truck every 1.5 minutes running out of the basin and then running back in later in the day.
For a total of something like 900 oil tanker truck trips out of the basin every day? Isn't that what you were reporting?
I believe that's right, yeah. You know, you sit on the highway and watch, you could expect a huge oil tanker truck every minute and a half, all day, every day.
That's Chris D'Angelo. He's a senior reporter for the Huffington Post. We'll put a link to his article on Jim Finley on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. What would this mean for the Uinta Basin? I mean, on one hand, let's say Jim Finley's vision plays out, and we'll get to one of the limiting factors of that here in a moment, which is just how much of that waxy stuff is out there. But let's say that his vision does play out. He says it could be a boon for the basin, but what would it mean for that place? Air quality is one that has come up in this conversation.
I don't think that there's any disputing that it would be hugely beneficial financially for the basin. There'd be a lot of money. I think there already is a lot of money flowing around.
Yeah.
You mentioned air quality. I mean, your listeners are very familiar with the air quality issues in the basin as, you know, already. Mm. I spoke to an expert about this. You know, Seth Lyman, he's at Utah State University. And, you know, he said it's not necessarily a one-to-one, you know, like this much additional production would cause this much more air quality, because he said, you know, producers are getting better about limiting ozone and ozone-forming pollutants. But he acknowledged, you know, there's a real concern about what emissions and air pollution would look like under a massive surge in oil and gas production. I mean, environmentalists say, you know, talk about it all the time. It's like the basin is left with the environmental and health consequences of this. Mm. I don't know that we know what that would look like, but I think there is reason to believe that it would be potentially problematic.
I guess the question is, who's paying for all of this? And that is to say, how reliant is this project on federal subsidies and tax dollars? We understand that Finley and other producers stand to make a lot of money, but are they making it on the backs of taxpayers?
I mean, there has undeniably been a large effort to funnel costs onto taxpayers, starting with the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition securing $28 million from the Utah Permanent Community Impact Fund to design and engineer and plan for the railroad. There was a huge pot of money to do highway improvements on Highway 191. And those improvements, Finley Resources has said, you know, were key to sort of continuing to grow production and move this stuff. That was sort of portrayed as a public safety issue, that the money was needed to safeguard the public from this increase in trucks. I think it's hard for environmental groups to see that as anything more than money to allow this industry to continue to grow.
Last session, the legislature approved a request for $88 million in funds for road improvements to that highway you mentioned, Highway 191. And the request comes from someone you write about, a state senator named Ron Winterton. You say in the piece he's this fierce supporter of the project. Tell us a little bit about him and some of the efforts that he's sort of been at to try to support the expansion of this project.
Yeah. So, I mean, he represents much of the basin.
Yeah.
He's been a very vocal supporter of the rail project. One of the more interesting things that he did was the $28 million that the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition got from the Permanent Community Impact Board. It was a very controversial move because, you know, these funds are they're supposed to go to communities that are most impacted by oil and gas development, mm-hmm. not to advance more oil and gas development. And so in 2021, Winterton introduced a bill that basically amended the statute that governed the use of those mineral funds to strip language requiring that they be used for these public finance impact projects, funds to be used for alleviating the costs of oil and gas production. And of course, people saw that as a giveaway to the industry that the railway is you know, largely going to benefit. Mm-hmm. And then also Winterton in 2019, he sponsored legislation that didn't pass, but it would have eliminated the state's 7.5% sales tax that oil and gas companies pay for equipment and materials. Mm-hmm. So everything from like piping and tractors. And that's something that Finley himself has been pretty vocal about, pushing Utah to sort of incentivize the oil and gas industry and and sending a signal to the industry to invest here in Utah. But yeah, Senator Winterton has definitely done arguably more than anyone in the state to try to assist the industry with advancing this boom, so to speak.
One of the people you talked to for your piece, a retired industry professional, said Finley was, this is how he put it, the puppet master of Utah officials in this process. Talk a little bit about the way he uses money to fund his sort of the politicians, I guess, that he supports. He's a big political donor anyway, you say. And in recent cycles, he's given away a lot, for example, to Mike Lee, who's been a big, I guess, as I understand it, a big champion of this railway idea and expanding this project in the basin.
Yeah, he's a big political donor at the federal level. It's harder to know at the state level, but his two companies are members of the Utah Petroleum Association, which obviously lobbies heavily for projects like this. I included his donation to Mike Lee because I thought that was particularly interesting. In 2022, Finley gave him $5,800.
That's
and
it?
Lee, I think that's the max.
Yeah, but, that's the max, I'm kidding.
Yeah. And Lee kind of turned around and, well, in addition to kind of condemning the court's decision in a number of ways, I think he's, you know, something to the effect of he accused the court of being woke environmentalists, something to that effect. He introduced an amendment to last year's military appropriations bill that basically would have rubber stamped the rail line and removed any ability for courts to review federal approvals of the project, which sort of interesting given kind of his, Mike Lee often talks about being a champion of the rule of law, but, you know, sort of steps into stymie the court from making this decision. That amendment didn't ultimately go anywhere, but Representative John Curtis has since introduced basically the same thing to a transportation appropriations bill. And someone I talked to kind of compared this to what Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, did to greenlight the Mountain Valley Pipeline. So there is still a very concerted effort to see this thing through.
Okay, so let's say they manage to expand the project. What could happen, you say, is it could basically triple the production in the Uinta Basin. And Finley's vision, of course, again, is, expanding the economy, all of this growth in these communities, as you said, banks and stores and schools and all of those kinds of things. But you also introduced this question about just how much of this waxy crude is actually there. Based on what we know, you say, they could blow through all of that in as few as 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, this kind of really gets at the question of, like, is this the right way to develop such a unique resource given all of its uses in, lubricants for wind turbines and heat pumps? And, the best estimates for proven reserves of crude oil is somewhere between 550 and 700 million barrels. Industry folks would say and told me that, reserves are often wildly low, that basins that are productive continue to be productive long after we think they would have been. But, I guess if you doubled that or tripled that, you're still looking at 10, 15 years potentially if they're hauling 350,000 barrels a day.
Still finite, right?
Yeah, it's definitely finite. Yeah. I mean, but that's what's interesting about, when Finley presented to the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition in 2021, he sort of started the presentation by talking about this vast resource, that this thing is, he talked about there's potentially 1 trillion barrels of oil in place and maybe as much as 2 trillion barrels of oil in place, but that isn't crude, and the rest of what's there, the vast majority of what's there, is sort of dirty tar sands and oil shale that is not economically viable at the moment. So the way he talks about it would signal, I think, that they have grand plans beyond just getting crude. And I don't think that's necessarily a secret. They're producing gas too. But, that sort of changes the conversation, I think, depending on who you are and what you want to see. And I think it's also interesting just because this is a very unique product. And I don't think we know where all will end up, right? Like, is a lot of this going to be sent to Gulf Coast refineries and shipped overseas?
Yeah. It's not all going to ChapStick is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, we hear a lot about energy independence and energy dominance. It is kind of interesting to think that Utah is potentially shipping a lot of its highest quality crude to Gulf Coast refineries and on to someplace else.
Hmm. Well, and there's also the question that let's say that waxy crude does run out in 7, 8, 9 years, whatever. How does that leave the Uinta Basin? How does it leave the economy there that's been counting on this stuff to provide jobs and money for the region? I mean, what happens then? And if you're Jim Finley, is it worth it just those 7 or 8 years? In other words, would he even have to care if the resource runs out, that he got out of it what he put into it?
I did some math of, based on what Finley Resources and Uinta Wax are producing at the moment, and sort of if the current crude oil prices of around $70 a barrel, I mean, it amounts to essentially $700 million in pre-tax revenue a year.
Wow.
What it would mean for the basin, I mean, I think environmental groups and critics worry about sort of the boom and bust. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people in the basin that hope that it opens the door to producing oil shale and that this continues to grow and they can access what isn't accessible at the moment. I don't know. Again, there are a lot of people talking about this as if it is just a massive resource that is not going to dry up anytime soon. And maybe these producers have information that I'm not privy to. I'm sure they do. from the numbers I have and have seen, it wouldn't last that long, even if you double or triple what we think's out there. So, and then it sort of becomes a question of well, what's the railroad going to do? What's the use for it beyond oil?
You mean if you spend $3 billion on a railroad and you run out of waxy crude, what do you do with that infrastructure then?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other ways that Jim Finley has his fingers in sort of every aspect of production there is he has a frack sand facility in the basin. So they're mining the sand used for hydraulic fracturing, is one of the reasons that production is soaring there. So now, you know, he's sourcing sand to do hydraulic fracturing in the basin. And my understanding is like that was one of the things that would have been shipped into the basin on this new rail line. So I don't have a clear sense of what would be coming the other direction on this rail line, what other uses it would be beneficial for. And like you said, it's $3 billion.
What could stop it? And I don't just mean the rail line. What could stop the expansion of this project, trucking, rail included? Anything?
Well, I mean, the court ruling certainly puts the new rail line on the back burner for now. Finley's transloading facility, which is called Wildcat Loadout, is on Bureau of Land Management property. And so currently that facility has the capacity to ship 30,000 barrels of crude out on rail per day. Well, they have an expansion plan that would basically grow that to 100,000 barrels a day, which means more trucks, which means more crude oil train cars going through Colorado. Mm. You know, so BLM stands in between that expansion happening or not happening. Interestingly enough, I asked the BLM about this proposed expansion, and they essentially told me that they aren't currently reviewing it because there was some incomplete information on the part of the applicant. So it's kind of unclear to me at the moment where that thing stands, but Finley talks about it as if they want to get approval to go to 100,000 barrels a day. And then there is another transloading facility that also has an expansion plan. And essentially, if these transloading facilities expand to these targets, you could see 200,000 plus barrels per day leaving the basin on rail cars without the Uinta Basin Railway. And that's not, 200,000 barrels a day is not 350,000 barrels a day, which is what the Uinta Basin Railway would allow for, but it's a lot.
What do you think will happen when you look at the political landscape? What do you think the prospects are for this project? Again, both the trucking part of it and the rail line part of it.
That's a tough question. It's very clear to me that area producers have really set their sights on huge growth and are sort of, as one person put it, throwing spaghetti at the wall to make that happen. I think that the new rail line being sidelined I think that's a multi-year delay. I don't think that Finley and other producers are slow trucking until something forces them to. I do wonder if they start to shift their focus away from Wildcat Loadout because it's Bureau of Land Management land, and that's more complicated than a transloading facility on private land. But I think they're going to keep meeting resistance from counties in Colorado and downline communities who will have to watch a growing number of oil trains run through remote mountain landscapes and along sensitive watersheds.
Chris D'Angelo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris D'Angelo, he's a senior reporter for the Huffington Post. We'll put a link to his article on Jim Finley on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the man who's been described as the puppet master of Utah's energy policy. He's a Texas oil man named Jim Finley, and in a recent article for the Huffington Post, the journalist Chris D'Angelo wrote about Finley's plan to nearly triple the crude oil production in the Uinta Basin. We spoke this week to Sam Van Wetter. He's with the advocacy organization the Rural Utah Project. And Van Wetter says Finley's vision would mark a transformation of that area.
It will change from being this vast, roadless, wild area into a place of commerce and industry, which has no guaranteed benefit for its communities and really has no longevity for a continued industry in this region. In my perception, Finley Resources is willing to helicopter into the area, to use it for what it's worth, and then to leave without any obligation for cleanup or long-term care for what has been there for longer than we have.
So one of the places that will be affected if Utah leaders and lawmakers help fund Finley's vision for the basin will be Nine Mile Canyon. For those who don't know that much about it, will you describe the place and say why you think it's special?
For those who don't know much about it, I'll invite them to visit. It is an astonishing place. It's been called the world's longest art gallery, and it is replete with these indigenous petroglyphs and pictographs that adorn the canyon walls. You enter from Carbon County, just south of Price in Wellington, and you drive east. The Tavaputs Plateau rises up around you. You go past Minimod Creek, and you go into Nine Mile Canyon, past these formerly working ranches, one or two of which are still in operation. And you begin to see these signs. They're these fabulous little interpretive signs that were put together as a collaboration between the Bureau of Land Management and Carbon County's Recreation Promotion Department. And they're invented names, obviously, for these panels. We don't know what indigenous communities might have called them when they were created. Some of them seem like maps. Some of them seem like familial history. Some of them seem like an epic story of a great hunt or a great battle. It's a place where the layers of human history that have spent time in this canyon and have cared for this place are readily apparent. We see the recent history of these pioneer ranching stock who were building the houses and structures there, taming some of the land and irrigating it so that it could produce pasture and feed for livestock. We see evidence of the Buffalo Soldiers who wrote their names in axle grease inscriptions, primarily in Gate Canyon. And then older than that, the indigenous history that is layered in the place, that is baked into it. Many of the artifacts, the relics, the physical pieces are gone. Nine Mile Canyon was slow to be protected, and I would argue still has insufficient protections for the stories that it holds.
You've said it makes you feel puny being in that canyon, but also kind of at the center of the universe. What do you mean?
I think when I take in a panel, pictographs or petroglyphs, I inevitably think of who might have made this, what they were experiencing, the message that they were trying to send. I can put myself in those shoes, you know, I can imagine what it would have been like to be there, to be chipping away at the rock, to be creating an image peck by peck. And it makes me think that I'm but a blip, that this rock, this cliff wall, and the image upon it will be there longer than I will be here on this earth. It was here much before I was too. But the sheer focus of Nine Mile Canyon, the way that it holds you, the way that it directs your attention, and the way that all this art invites us to imagine our past and dig into the protection of it into the future. It's an amazing context to stand in.
We should say, Sam, that you're not only concerned about Nine Mile Canyon, of course. There's another area that you say will be affected if Finley's project succeeds, and this is Gate Canyon. It's kind of a way into Nine Mile Canyon. Tell us about Gate Canyon.
Gate Canyon is an access canyon to Nine Mile. It's not one that most of us use to visit the canyon. Most of us, as I say, will drive in from Wellington to see Nine Mile. But if one should like to make a loop in which you enter that way and leave a different part of the canyon, Gate Canyon is really, really the only way to get out of the place without turning around and doubling back. Gate Canyon is about 6 miles. It's a relatively short piece of canyon compared to the almost 40 miles of Nine Mile. And Gate Canyon spurs off to the north, winds its way through dirt and these switchbacks next to towering cliff walls until it tops out on the Tavaputs. And it meets pavement again up there, and eventually it'll connect you to Mighton and the oil fields that exist up in Duchesne County there. Gate Canyon is where many of these axle grease inscriptions from the Buffalo Soldiers exist. There are a few small indigenous rock art panels in Gate Canyon. Proponents of paving Gate Canyon say that they'll improve it. But you go and visit, you see the wild, winding road as it currently exists, and it's hard to imagine it could be made any better with human intervention.
So Gate Canyon, though, is not paved, at least not now. If Finley's project goes forward, leaders, industrialists like him, want to pave it, not only pave it, sort of change it, straighten it, I guess.
I would say they will utterly transform it if they succeed in paving Gate Canyon. Gate Canyon is the final 5.5-6 mile stretch that is unpaved between the oil fields in Duchesne County and the rail transfer site in Wellington in Carbon County. And those tiny 6 miles are all that's preventing the industry from using Nine Mile Canyon and its extension in Gate Canyon to be a hydrocarbon highway. Those 6 miles, they would also need to grade and straighten. They've proposed increasing the speed limit in this primitive dirt road with pavement to up to 55 miles an hour. And it's astonishing to think about when you're there, because it is a slow drive. It is a washboarded drive, and it bends back and forth around the natural topography of the area. In order to pave it, they would also have to straighten it out and level it down so that it is drivable by all manner of vehicles. It would destroy the place, in my opinion.
So Nine Mile Canyon, it's already paved. And you've said, in fact, for Nine Mile anyway, that was actually a good thing for the canyon. Explain a little bit about that, if you would.
It was a controversial topic when it was done, and that was done in part to protect the rock art resources that are there. Previous to that paving project, the road was treated with magnesium chloride once or twice a year. That's a treatment that can impact the local groundwater and wildlife living there just by that chemical treatment. The dust that an unpaved road produces is a threat to rock art. It hangs in the air and clings to the rock and can increase and quicken erosion of those cultural resources. And also, the pavement was an improvement for the ranchers and the folks who live out there. For example, Nine Mile Canyon Ranch, which is a lovely spot where you can rent a guest house and talk to the folks who run it and learn a little bit more about the personal history they have with the place. But Nine Mile Canyon Ranch was immediately adjacent to the road. In the repaving project, they were able to move that primary road about a quarter mile away from the ranch. So in paving, they were able to afford those residents a little bit more privacy and a little bit more quietude. I will also say that paving Nine Mile Canyon Road, they didn't install culverts. There are many water crossings, many ephemeral streams that could run across the road. And they didn't install culverts, which would enable the cars to go over that water. Instead, there are paved dips, which by nature of their design, keep speeds low on Nine Mile Canyon Road. That design feature, and I don't know for sure whether it was made to do so, but it's had this effect, has kept speeds relatively low in Nine Mile Canyon.
So what would it mean to have upward of 900 tanker trucks moving through that area? I mean, it wouldn't be necessarily physical damage to the rock art there necessarily, but you say it's some other kind of damage. What would that mean?
I think that if we enable and allow industry traffic to inundate Nine Mile Canyon Road, it is an existential threat for this jewel of Utah's cultural landscape. Instead of going and feeling like you're the only person in the universe communing with this old art, getting a sense for how people have lived here and cared for this place forever, instead, you'll be accompanied by large-scale mechanized travel. You'll be accompanied by what some estimate to be one truck every 3 minutes through Nine Mile Canyon. The industry is such that they have to move the oil quickly. The viscous, waxy crude oil hardens in cooler temperatures and over time. And so it is their prerogative to move that as quickly as possible into heated train tankers. This means that they will be constantly moving oil, creating traffic in a place that is currently kind of a one-way, a dead-end canyon. To enable that passage would utterly change the place.
How far along is Jim Finley's project?
Well, for better or worse, the project has had a series of starts and stops. There's this overarching plan, which we've seen laid out by Finley Resources, to improve the infrastructure and increase production. With the diligent work of environmental activists, local politicians, and other stakeholders, some of these initiatives have gone a good ways, spent an amazing amount of taxpayer money, only to be stopped by courts, public intervention, and by federal land management policies and environmental assessments. However, it's necessary to recognize this as a many-headed beast. Oil production in the Uinta Basin is a hydra, and when we cut off one head, such as the Uinta Basin rail line, another head will get the attention. And so, as easy and as tempting as it is to celebrate our victories of creating setbacks for some of these large-scale publicly funded infrastructure projects, it's vital to recognize places like Gate Canyon, which are a small goal, a 6 mile stretch that they wish to pave that would increase production and transport in a way that is not insignificant.
Sam Van Witter, thank you very much.
Glad to speak with you.
Sam Van Witter, he's a field organizer for the Rural Utah Project. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you with comments or suggestions. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program was produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.